This is KZSU, Stanford. Welcome to Entitled Opinions. My name is Robert Harrison, and we're coming to you from the Stanford campus. To get into the studios of KZSU, you have to go down four, five, six stairs and unlock a nondescript metal door, from which threshold you descend a few more stairs before entering the dimly lit environment of a pulsating radio station full of posters, photos, bulletin boards, psychedelic artwork, a sea of electronic gadgets, wires, consoles, headsets, stacks of CDs and LPs, and some weird-looking disc jockeys with freaky hair and unbranded Kool-Aid. KZSU is about 6 feet below street level, just about right for a radio station that plays a lot of underground music and that broadcasts a program like Entitled Opinions, which is an underground cult show for people who are not afraid to think and who prefer the blood of Odysseus's black ram to the wonder bread of NPR or the scones of the BBC. Siete voi qui ser brunetto? This is KZSU. My name is Robert Harrison, and we're coming to you from the underworld. Or more precisely, from the catacombs. That's right, here we are in the catacombs, like the early Christians, in the underground burial sites of the imperial city, practicing a persecuted religion. In our case, the religion is that of reflective thought, and our communion is a communion with the dead, who carry on their afterlife in the books, poems, and ideas that we spend most of our time discussing on this show. Those of you out there who join in our feasts and who think for yourselves instead of having things spoon-fed to you by the providers, I mean the media and this vast Borg collective we call the World Wide Web, well, you know as well as I do that thoughtful reflection is indeed a persecuted religion these days. We have an extremely interesting show for you today. Our topic is an unusual one for Entitled Opinions, the transistor and the digital revolution it made possible. The initial impetus for this show comes from an email I received a few months ago from a listener who wrote the following, quote, I am concerned about this country's future. Our young generation is not as tech-savvy as everyone thinks. In fact, they are less knowledgeable about technology than my generation, age 56. They simply know better how to use it, that's all. Is someone who uses a telephone, TV, or radio tech-savvy? How many people even know what AM and FM mean? I'm not sure kids today have ever seen vacuum tubes. Do they know how many transistors are in their computers? I suspect not. I recall, many years ago, being excited about getting a 9-transistor radio. I still remember that after all these decades. Today's modern CPUs have about 700 million transistors and as many on the video card, over a billion in one system. Only us older folks can appreciate that. End quote. I will confess that when I first read that communication, I did not have the foggiest idea how many transistors were in a computer or video card. In fact, I was not even sure I could tell you what exactly a transistor is. All I knew was that I used to listen to transistor radios in the old days. In fact, I still have one that I keep near my bed, and it still works like a charm. So, the first thing I did after reading that email was to try and find out the basic facts about the transistor, and, while I was at it, find out what AM and FM stand for. Because let's face it, it's pretty appalling, when you think about it, that you can host a radio show that airs on KZSU 90.1 FM and not know what FM stands for. What I discovered in my research is that the transistor may well be the most momentous invention of the 20th century. And that's saying a lot, because the 20th century is responsible for more momentous inventions than any other century in human history. So trust me when I say that we have a fascinating show on tap for you today about the transistor and other related developments in electronics that have changed the basic fabric of the world we live in, speak in, and hear in. Above all, hear in, for in the past few decades, we have witnessed staggering revolutions in recording technologies that have brought about wholesale changes in various sectors, including, most notably, the music industry. So brace yourselves for a joyride. My guest today is exactly the right person to take us on that ride. His name is Jay Kadis. He is the chief audio engineer at Stanford's Center for Computer Research in Music and Acoustics, otherwise known as CARMA. Jay regularly teaches audio recording classes at Stanford. He is a supreme sound engineer as well as musical producer. Let me also mention that he's a Bay Area native and a very accomplished musician in his own right, a guitar player, in fact. His late 60s band, The Misanthropes, played at the Fillmore and opened for Muddy Waters, which is truly amazing. Jay has played with many other rock bands since, and he is interested in all aspects of music and recording technologies. And in addition to all this expertise, he also knows what a transistor is. Jay, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Robert.
So before we talk about the transistor, Jay, CARMA, pretty fancy outfit you have there. Can you tell our listeners what takes place at CARMA and how was it founded?
Well, it was founded originally as a research center to basically explore the use, the ability of the computer to be applied to different aspects of music, from the synthesis of music to the analysis of music, and basically to see what you could do with a computer in the musical environment. And it's sort of grown from there to the point now where we teach courses on everything from the basic programming of digital signal processing software to designing hardware interfaces between humans and computers to be used as musical instruments. So basically designing new digital musical instruments that may bear absolutely no resemblance to any existing form of musical input, and everything in between. So we study psychoacoustics and what acoustics of musical instruments, room acoustics, things like that, and also all of the things you can do to music or with music using a computer, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So you find that being a musician yourself, going into this more technical, the electronic underworld of sound and music is a pretty easy kind of transition?
For some people it is. It sort of depends on your brain, because some people have a facility for working with technical stuff, and some people have a facility for artistic creativity, and some people can do both. And actually there are quite a number of people in the latter category.
I can't do both. I can tell you I had to take a air clearance test, you know, in order to have my show here on KZSU. I had to memorize what all these buttons in front of me on the console mean.
Oh, yeah.
What you have to do to get this station up at 6 in the morning if it's been off, and what to do in case of emergency. But I tell you, when I look at the electronics and something is not working, I am in full admiration of the chief engineer who can go in there and actually work with the wires and figure out how these things work, because for me it's a complete maze and a forest that I can't get into at all.
Well, it's a separate discipline, and you sort of have to spend some time with that discipline if you really want to get, you know, develop the facility with it.
So I quoted from this listener about, you know, the transistor. and how when he was young, he remembered the first 9 transistor radio to come out, which was an amazing thing.
I had one of those.
You had one of those.
It was a candle. That was the brand from Japan. And I used to sleep with it under my pillow so I could listen to radio dramas from the 30s on AM radio all night.
Well, I mentioned I still have one, and it's handheld, and you can turn it on and off. It's the best thing to have near your bed. You
know? Oh, yeah, that's great.
But when he said that he remembered how excited he was that there was a 9 transistor, I take it that before the 9 transistor, it was like 1 or 2 transistors.
2 or 3, I think.
2 or 3?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So from that time, like the 9 transistor radio to our own time, a huge revolution has taken place, and the transistor is at the heart of it, no?
Yeah, it's sort of like the discovery of fire, I think, in a way, the way it has sort of revolutionized society. I mean, that might be putting a little too much emphasis on it, but the transistor has developed into such a complex instrument, the computer. And essentially, a computer is just a huge collection of individual transistors, and the magic is in the way they're connected and the way they're programmed to behave.
What exactly is a transistor before we talk about the computer?
Well, a transistor is sort of the fundamental building block of modern analog electronics. And by analog, we mean that we have a continuously varying signal of some sort. So, for example, sound is a continuously varying, changing pressure of the air that surrounds us. And then when we put a microphone in front of it, it converts that air pressure variation to an electrical variation. And again, it's continuous. So it has a discrete value at any time that you want to measure it. This is then converted into what's called a discrete or digital signal by the computer, because the computer can only work with individual numbers. So it can't actually do continuous processing like analog electronics do. So it has to chop things up. And it does chop them up in very fine increments, and so that to us humans, it appears as though it's a continuous output.
Is that what a byte is, by the way?
A byte is a collection of bits.
And is a bit one of these little?
A bit is an individual, a yes or no decision, basically.
Yes or no decision.
It's a binary number which we implement in the computer by either having a voltage or no voltage.
So it's on or off.
Exactly.
And that is what the transistor regulates?
Well, that's one use for the transistor. The transistor can also be used as a continuous analog device. And so it can be used as an amplifier or a rectifier, to build 9 transistor radios.
Yeah. And when you say amplifier, I also, of course, looked up what does AM stand for? And I found out that it means amplitude modification.
Modulation, yeah.
As opposed to
frequency
FM,
modulation.
Which is frequency modulation. And I read that stuff and I try to make sense of it. I still can't tell you what the difference between frequency modulation.
Amplitude modulation is the same thing as a volume control. So if you apply a signal as a modulator, it just controls the amplitude of the other signal. That's how AM radio works. So there's a constant carrier. That's what the antenna puts out. And it's modulated by the analog signal of your voice or the music. And that makes it the actual amplitude at the antenna go up and down. Frequency modulation, rather than modulating the amplitude of that signal, modulates its frequency about a center. So if you say you have a 90.1, I think that's the frequency here, 90.1 megahertz, then as the amplitude of your voice goes up, the frequency goes up. And as the amplitude of your voice goes down, the frequency goes down. So it modulates the signal, but in frequency rather than in amplitude. And that's the difference between AM and FM.
And why is there still such a thing as AM after FM came around?
Well, the way the signals behave in the atmosphere is different. And AM radio actually can bounce off the stratosphere because it's a charged layer in the atmosphere and can come back down. So you can get better spread. It travels more distantly. FM is shadowed by other objects. So it doesn't, for example, go under underpasses as well as AM does.
So that's why when you were a band and you got on AM radio, it was much more important than FM radio, right?
Well, actually, FM radio was always kind of looked upon as a sort of a secondary medium, because AM radio had been really developed before FM became popular, and so that it was sort of considered the real radio. And then all the offshoot things like KMPX or KSAN in San Francisco that played all that hippie music, that's FM.
Did you ever get on that?
No, but I knew some of the – I had a friend who wanted to be a DJ, so we hung out in those places quite a bit.
Well, about the transistor, going back to the role of the transistor, I read in my research, and my research, by I mean the slow life, you know, stuff that I get online. In 2002, someone wrote about 60 million transistors were built for each man, woman, and child on Earth in the year 2002. That's a staggering number of transistors per individual.
Well, yeah, but think about how many brain cells you have.
Okay.
That's a lot more than there are transistors. So, you know, it's a proportional kind of thing.
But how can we go from having a 9-transistor radio to having like 60 million transistors per individual? In other words, all these transistors, there's millions if not billions in a computer, I take
yes.
it, right?
Mm-hmm. But they're all built on one piece of silicon. So it's basically a fabrication issue. The individual transistors themselves are pretty much the same thing. But when they first came out, each one was packaged in its own little metal or plastic can. So if you wanted 9 transistors, you had 9 little metal cans. Well, now you can manufacture microscopically sized transistors on a substrate, and you can basically create millions or billions of them on a single piece of silicon. And so it's just basically it's all manufacturing. The actual transistors themselves are very similar to the originals, but they've been miniaturized and the manufacturing processes have been optimized to the point where you can cram that many into a very small space.
And am I correct in assuming that this has really infiltrated all sorts of domains of, certainly technological activity, but also in what you do, for example, recording?
Oh, dramatically.
And even what we're doing right here, which is recording a show on the radio, broadcasting it on KZSU, and then it's going to be podcast
right.
on iTunes and on the webpage.
Mm-hmm.
How many billions of transistors are we using just for this one-hour show?
Well, I don't know. What computer have you got in there?
Well, we have a Macintosh, I suppose.
Oh, I don't know. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, we have a Mac 5 down here.
Is it G5? Well, G5. That's an older processor, so it's hard to say how many.
What I mean is that I read that every time you Google something, you're using, you know, millions, if not billions of transistors.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Well, we're getting kind of – well, I mean we're getting to the point where we're sort of wasting them at this point. But, I mean, we have more capability than we can actually use.
Can I ask you, Jay, about some of the possible cultural – not cultural, but let's say even psychological implications, because you also studied the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And you are also interested in psychoacoustics, as you call it.
Right.
But I'm actually interested in what something like the technology of the 0-1 or the transistor, what the transistor enables in the computer to not just affect human behavior or human psychology, but also to serve as a kind of constraint in terms of a model of for a human thing. I was reading in the New York Times just published. I don't know if this is jumping too much in the realm of speculation, but there's this article.
No problem with that.
No problem. Okay. It's called. The article is called "In the Calculations of Online Dating, Love Can Be Cruel," and it says that now, with these people who are doing online dating, mm-hmm. they have to answer all sorts of questions. You know, and these questions do take the form of a yes or no, or on or off.
Right.
Red hair, yes or no, or you know. Any kind of personality trait is becoming a yes or no kind of thing. And then individuals in the system are broken down into bits, which are personality traits or physical traits and things of that sort. And it seems like there's been a shattering of the core of selfhood into a whole series of things. That's just one example I came across today.
Well, that may be a misapplication of existing technology, because if you think about it, you could take a picture or a video of somebody, which would convey much more information than yes or no questions, and still convert it all to digital information. You just have a lot more of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you believe that the computer technology is doing anything to reprogram our brains?
I think it has changed something in our nervous systems, because the immediacy of the fulfillment of our expectations that computers deliver. We used to wait for stuff. Like, you know, things would come in the mail Now we get email, and we expect an instantaneous reply. I think that it's had some effect on that level, but in a general sense, I'm not sure that it's really made significant changes in the basic essence of humanity, because it hasn't been around long enough. Nothing in the way of natural selection will have taken place, selecting for people who relate better to digital technology or anything like that. So we're still at the infancy, really, of the whole revolution that was brought about by the transistor, although we've been through, you know, several generations. But if you look at it on a geological time scale, you know, it's infinitesimal. So I don't know.
Well, we are in the infancy of this new digital revolution for sure. But at the same time, this guy who used to be the guru of virtual reality, Jaron Lanier, mm-hmm. the great apologist, he believed in the brave new world of this complete liberation of humanity through computer technology and the internet and so forth. He has just come out with a book. In fact, I've invited Jaron Lanier to come on the show, and hopefully he'll accept it.
That would be great.
He'll speak for himself. But nevertheless, reading this book of his, You Are Not a Gadget, he's not really an apostate, because he still believes in the liberatory potential of the medium, but he's very skeptical about what direction it has taken and is taking as we speak. And here I'd like to bring up something that you have a expert knowledge about, which is he uses more as an example or a metaphor, which is the invention of the MIDI. And this takes us right back here home at Stanford, mm-hmm. because in the early 80s, this, as he says, a music synthesizer designer named Dave Smith casually made up a way to represent musical notes. It was called MIDI. His approach conceived of music from a keyboard player's point of view. MIDI was made of digital patterns that represented keyboard events like key down and key up. And before we go on to talk about what Lanier makes of the MIDI as a metaphor for all sorts of other things regarding the transformation of human selfhood, can you elaborate a little bit about what MIDI is? And
yeah, sure. It's a communication protocol between digital instruments. So synthesizers can talk to each other. They can talk to a mixing board or signal processing device. Essentially, you can send arbitrary information encoded as values. So you can send a value between 0 and 128, or I guess 256, depending on whether you're sending control information or note information. But the idea is that it's basically sending values between one machine and another, and the machines have to agree on what those values mean, where they are applied. So it's just an interchange protocol, and it's up to the designers of these machines to implement what happens when they receive an instruction. So the instructions can be interpreted as play this note, or they can be interpreted as okay, change the pattern that you're using, or load a new equalizer, or some other process.
Okay, well, regarding the musical application of it, I'm going to quote again Lanier. He said that given that it was representing the keyboard events like key up and key down, he said that meant that it could not describe the curvy transient expressions a singer or a saxophone player can produce. It could only describe the tile mosaic world of the keyboardist, not the watercolor world of the violin. And then he says there was no reason for MIDI to be concerned with the whole of musical expression, since Dave only wanted to connect some synthesizers together so he could have a larger palette of sounds while playing a single keyboard. And then he says that in spite of its limitations, that it's note dependent, MIDI became the standard scheme to represent music in software. Music programs and synthesizers were designed to work with it, and it quickly proved impractical to change or dispose of all that software and hardware. MIDI became entrenched. And despite Herculean efforts to reform it on many occasions, it still remains the standard. And then he goes on to say that, like railroads, when they lock in on a certain commitment, for example, the space between railroad tracks, you're locked in for a long time, for centuries. And he says that software is worse than railroads, because it must always adhere with absolute perfection to a boundlessly particular, arbitrary, tangled, intractable messiness. And he said, so while Lock-in may be a gangster in the world of railroads, it is an absolute tyrant in the digital world. So if I can just go on, MIDI now exists in your phone and in billions of other devices. It is the lattice on which almost all the popular music you hear is built. Much of the sound around us, the ambient music and audio beeps, the ringtones and alarms are conceived in MIDI. And he says that before MIDI, a musical note was a bottomless idea that transcended absolute definition. After MIDI, a musical note was no longer just an idea, but a rigid, mandatory structure you couldn't avoid in the aspects of life that had gone digital. And then he goes on to say, throughout this book, I'll explore whether people are becoming like MIDI notes, overly defined and restricted in practice to what can be represented in a computer. Before we talk about that last remark.
Well, I think that's a grossly unfair picture of MIDI, because MIDI actually opened the world up for music. And it really went a long way to change the way people – for example, I've got a bunch of MIDI equipment at home. I can sit down and flesh out a song without a bunch of other musicians around to see if it works, just to see – or if I want to change the key, all I have to do is push a button and the key will be shifted. So it provides an amazing amount of flexibility if you know how to use it. It locks you in a certain sense. That's true. But that was not what it was designed for. And if you use it for what it was designed for, it's a superb way of communication. Or it wouldn't have survived so long. It's still used, and it's been, 81 or 82, so 25, 30 years that I'm going to check my math.
Yeah. Well, no, it's
but,
yeah.
But that's the point. I don't think that Dave Smith ever intended for this to last this long, nor would he have predicted that it would.
Was Dave Smith associated with Karma?
No, he was at Sequential Circuits, I believe, in San Jose. Yeah. But there was a consortium of people producing digital keyboards that got together and agreed on this. When was the last time you heard of General Motors and Ford getting together to agree on something? This was a really groundbreaking thing in the musical world. And so I don't think it should be demonized. I think it should be recognized for what it is, which is a limited protocol to connect machines together, and it's been exploited by some rather clever people so that a lot of its fundamental limitations have been, gotten around in some way. So that's why it's still with us.
Well, this is an example of lock-in on the one hand, and so he says that, someday another kind of digital design for describing speech will get locked in, but that design might then be adapted to music, and perhaps a more fluid and expressive sort of digital music will be developed. But even if that happens, 1,000 years from now, when a descendant of ours is traveling at relativistic speed to explore a new star system, she will probably be annoyed by some awful, beepy, MIDI-driven music to alert her that the antimatter filter needs to be recalibrated.
I think that's funny, but I don't think it's even nearly true.
You don't think so? Okay. But what about this idea that...
I understand the point.
Yeah, the people that. But what's more sinister is if this suggestion that people are becoming like MIDI notes, overly defined, restricted in practice to what can be represented in a computer. This book has a big polemic against organizations like Google, Facebook, Twitter, all these where they're getting all this free creative input and creating grids that. Are reducing the individual to larger units of organization where they become
digital. Right, but it's not like Google is implanted in our brains. So we have the ability to use it or not. So there are ways around it. And I use it for what it's good for, and I don't use it for other things. So, the humans are flexible. That's the issue, and that's not going to change. Humans are biological organisms, and there's a flexibility built in not only to our own development, but to our reproduction, so that we're adaptable. And computers aren't yet creating computers. So if that day comes, then we'll have an adversary, I think. Mm-hmm. But the way things stand, I'm not one of those people that really thinks of them as a. It's not negative or positive. It's how you use it, and of course, people use tools for good and for evil. Sure. So.
Well, this is great. I mean, I've many times on this show, I've claimed and lamented the fact that we it's nice to think that technology, contemporary technology, is an instrument to be used or misused, but that there might be some kind of self-deception about whether we are the masters of the technology or whether technology has an inner drive to that will eventually, whether it's a conscious drive or not, be the masters of us.
I think we have to be careful about that. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are things on the horizon that are potentially will get out of our control.
Anything come to mind?
Nanotechnology is one thing,
sure,
that I think we need to really watch, because it's not out there yet. And once it gets out there, it's conceivable that something on that scale could take on a life of its own.
Well, so, especially because you said we're biological organisms, but nanotechnology, from what I've learned about it in terms of when they start sending all these nanobytes or whatever into our mm-hmm. bloodstream in order to monitor cancer cells,
yeah,
all of a sudden it becomes part of our biological organism.
Yeah, I'm not real comfortable with that idea. I'd rather do it with proteins, I think, than something that we're creating from whole cloth and have no real idea where it's going. Just as Shockley and Bardeen didn't really know where the transistor was going to go.
Yeah. And are you suspicious of the market forces, or let's say capitalist forces?
Because they're only interested in the momentary gain they'll get from whatever they're doing. And they don't care, or they don't know, or they don't care what's coming, further down the pike. Because that's something that I have a real bone to pick with, the whole concept of, instant gratification and the capitalist idea that, we're going to grow and who cares what happens after us.
Yeah, and one of the polemics in this book I'm referring to is that this dogma among technologists that information is or should be free is actually playing into the hands of a few corporations that are using all this free stuff, free creativity.
Well,
let's
just say that not only should the information be free, but so should the interchange. And that's where it's not free, and that's where things are going awry.
Well, what I find interesting in our conversations that we've had before, Jay, is that you have no nostalgia for old technology when it comes to musical recording. And so whereas a lot of people will still, of our generation or yours, think that, the vinyl LP is much better, crisper, it's not the same thing on a CD sound and so forth, certainly not on, the MP3 file. The analog was somehow superior to the digital. But you think that, on the contrary, there's been a huge blessing.
Oh, absolutely.
Can you say something first about the difference between analog and digital technologies in terms of the recording process?
Well, the real difference is the idea of continuous versus discrete. That is something that's continually occurring versus something that's sampled, which would be the digital representation. We're essentially trying to do a representation of sound waves in electronics. So it's an imperfect problem because, for one thing, sound waves are three-dimensional and electronics are not. So you're always going to lose something when you do a recording. It's never going to convey exactly what you heard in the room. Maybe someday there are some approaches to that which come closer. For example, the dummy head, where you actually build a fleshy kind of head and stick microphones in the ears. If you wear headphones, it's very much – you can move that head around and it's very much like you're in the room. But if you're listening on loudspeakers, that doesn't work. So – to produce a representation of a sound event in rooms across the nation is a daunting proposition, and it has never been done perfectly. And analog didn't do it perfectly, and digital doesn't do it perfectly. So it's not as though there's some sort of fundamental difference in analog versus digital. It's all in the implementation of it and how you use it, knowing its limitations and knowing how to get the maximum productivity from it, or the maximum sound quality.
So for people who believe that albums on vinyl have a superior quality or a distinctive quality that you can't really get in the CD medium, are they just nostalgic for something that's not the case?
I think they're focusing on the wrong elements, or maybe different elements. I wouldn't say wrong, because people hear what they hear. But I grew up with analog recording and tape recorders. Now, admittedly, I wasn't using the top of the line, Studer or Ampex machines. But be that as it may, there were a lot of problems. I don't remember ever getting through a session without having to clean a cable or replace a cable or fix something, you know. And in the digital world, things don't sort of degrade the same way. They'll just stop entirely. And I spent a couple of hours this morning fighting with that up in our studio. But I think that the clarity and the alteration of the original signal is minimal in digital, and it's more in analog. If you have the ability to get the absolute best analog equipment there is, and this is something that not even a lot of the best studios are able to do because it's very expensive, you can get extremely good sounding recordings. But anyone who's ever heard the original master and then heard the album that was produced from it will realize that vinyl is not a perfect medium of delivery for sound. I absolutely hated surface noise. Drove me crazy because
you mean the scratching of
the needle? Well, pops and ticks. Vinyl was mass produced, so you got into manufacturing problems where they would start cutting the price of the vinyl because it was too expensive to use real virgin clean vinyl, and so they grind up old LPs and start making records out of that. And pretty soon, the surface noise was really obnoxious. And then you started having to pay for direct metal mastered, you know, special 180 gram vinyl discs that cost three or four times as much just to get reasonable sound quality. Now, if you did that and you had a terrific turntable, yeah, you could get good sound. But as soon as, you know, a truck drove by or the cat hair fell on the stylus, you know, it was all over. So, you know, I think for people, there may be a psychological thing about people who are really into audiophile sound. They just love the process of doing it and of cleaning their records and you know, putting them on. To them, it's sort of like playing an instrument.
Yeah, it's a ritual.
Yeah. Well, it maybe go even beyond that. To them, it's their instrument. They play this system to make the music come out, whereas musicians like us play an instrument, you know. So I think that there's a certain thing that people associate with the sound. And yeah, maybe it's ritual, but maybe it's just
– maybe it's musician envy.
Yeah, or something. Yeah, yeah. That's it.
That's great.
So I think that really enters into it.
And also when an LP gets old or after you've played it a few times, you say that it never really sounds the same.
Well, I had a professor who was an audiophile as well as a biology professor. He insisted that the first time you played a record, that the highest octave was essentially carved off by the stylus. So he would record them to cassette, which was arguably a worse medium for sound recording. But he just figured that he could capture what it was there and then play the tapes later and not play the record. I think he had a reel-to-reel machine also. So he may have actually been able to capture the entire spectrum that came off the record the first time he played it.
Okay, so the CD versus the LP is, we can say that there's not been a loss. There might even be an enhancement and a lot of benefits. How about when we go from the CD, which some people believe is becoming an obsolete entity, that is just an inefficient delivery form for individual songs or MP3 files, and that many people under a certain age get all their music from downloadable sites where they buy song by song,
mm-hmm.
is how much audio quality is lost, if any, in that process?
Well, it varies. You know, you can make a crappy sounding CD. You can make a crappy sounding LP. There's a lot of technical aspects that have to be right in order to make these things work. And CDs have their limitations too. Compact discs were envisioned, you know, a long time before they actually came to market. And at that point, there weren't enough transistors on some of those chips to really do things right. So, and the speeds of the computers were too low. So they were basically shoehorning this stuff into the minimum amount of bits they could use. Had we designed these today, we would have used a lot more bits and things would have sounded a lot better from the get-go. But early CDs had one big advantage over analog, and that was the low end. CDs could go all the way down to DC, direct current, so that you could get all the low frequencies perfectly. There's no analog recorder in the world that doesn't screw up the low end with head bump, and it's a function of the way magnetic tape heads work with magnetic tape, that there is just a low-end nonlinearity. And better machines sound better, but every analog machine ever built has a certain amount of head bump in it. So that's an alteration that's inherent in the medium. Maybe that's why some people like that. I don't know. I mean, especially for rock music, it could add a certain amount of punch that that we got used to hearing. And a lot of what we got used to hearing, and that's if you're, you know, my age, which is, you know, a child of the 60s, that's what you heard. You never heard anything but analog recordings until mid-80s probably. Maybe a little before that, because some of the studios started to try and work with some of the early digital recorders. But again, those had some pretty severe limitations. So you weren't getting really good digital sound right off the bat. And the early CDs that came out, also a lot of them were reissued masters that were designed for vinyl, which has a specific frequency response curve for which the mastering engineers incorporated into the masters. Well, if you play those tapes back on a perfectly flat compact disc, they're going to sound terrible. And that's what happened a lot of the time, I think, when we first switched to CD. But there are CDs out there that sound amazing. And if anybody can make a CD that sounds amazing, you can't blame the medium.
No, and you certainly can make amazing sounding CDs.
Well,
and
I'd say they sound okay.
They sound, yeah. Well, our listeners will hear about this later, about, you know, we've done a little collaboration, but it's not, we're not going to talk about that. But what I'd like to go through is the various stages of a recording process. So after everything has been recorded in the studio and it's been mixed, and then, you know, you have a mastered CD, and then you take, you send it away for manufacture, that master CD is of the highest possible quality you can get, and then you're actually manufacturing directly onto this, you know, the compact disc, and those CDs that go to market then are of a very high quality that you're describing.
Yes.
Now, that, let's say that goes to CD Baby, and they send it out to iTunes and the other downloadable sites. What happens when a CD goes into this other kind of form of the MP3 file?
Well, it's already a discrete representation of the original sounds, so it's chopped up into individual numbers. And all those processes do is use smaller numbers instead of big numbers. So if you go to an MP3, instead of using a 24-bit or a 16-bit word to encode each sample, the sample size gets diminished based on your ability to hear the difference between that. Essentially, the MP3 and all these data compression algorithms are using the human masking curves. That is, if we hear two sounds of the same frequency or similar frequency, and one of them is louder than the other, at some point, the louder sound will completely obliterate the quieter sound. And this is a phenomenon called masking. It's really a very important aspect in mixing and also in delivering sound to a listener, in that you can eliminate a lot of the raw data if you know that the person won't actually hear it, or you think they won't. So there are elaborate models of auditory perception that allow us to basically use smaller words for encoding the music, and therefore we can then send them over the internet quickly, as opposed to having to wait for something to download. And that's what MP3s and all the compression, the digital compression techniques take advantage of.
But there is a loss entailed.
Yes, there is. Yeah. Now, you may not notice it. If you're listening on a car radio or casually listening, you may not notice the difference. But if you put the two together, you will notice a difference. Mm-hmm. Virtually everyone would.
And talking about how all this technology has changed the music industry, since we're talking about music.
Stuck a knife in its back, pretty much.
At least for the commercial.
Well,
ones.
Because the music industry was based on selling a thing. It wasn't selling the music. It was selling an LP or a CD or some physical embodiment, and you had to have that to make the music play. Now you don't. And so now what are we selling? Well, we really aren't selling anything.
Well, you could say we were selling individual songs, if any, or
Well,
here's the question then: when it comes to music, is the whole concept of the album something that's becoming quickly obsolete?
I think it went obsolete almost overnight.
You think it's still
with
obsolete?
iTunes? Yeah. I'm still doing them, but I think that if you're trying to, you know, make a living doing this, that you're not going to be selling albums. You're selling performances now. So basically, the music is just a lost leader, and that, you know, the recorded music is a lost leader, and you make your money by doing live performances. That's the new paradigm for the music industry.
Well, I know that a lot of bands lament the fact that the album, the integrity and coherence and all the kind of thought that went into, you know, song sequence and, you know, consistency between one song and the other is something that certainly a lot of the musicians are still very committed to and are wondering what can change in terms of incorporating the new technology to make sure that the album, like the book, remains a fundamental unit of expression for
a band. Well, the only thing you could do is to make an MP3 that's the full length and not sell individual songs, but just sell the whole album as an MP3. That's physically possible, but the size gets up to the point where it's not an immediate download. But I don't see
how
why
about on the consumer side? Do you think there's something that is going to naturally push listeners to back to a larger unit, which is
maybe
the song
something
sequence?
Incorporating music and visual elements, you know, so that it becomes an experience again. So, you know, Blu-ray or DVD performances, not necessarily, you know, performances of the band playing the music, but of some kind of visual image that goes with the music. You know, think of Pink Floyd and, you know, images come to mind. So,
oh, sure. The Wall and their performance.
Yeah.
Of it.
Yeah. So things like that. But that, again, that makes it difficult for the musician because not only do they have to provide the music, but they have to get they have to now become videographers and program all of the visual elements as well. And there aren't that many folks that can do all that.
I was reading recently that almost every kind of music has been hit very hard and it's been declining in terms of sales dramatically. And in cases like jazz, very dramatically, the blues suffering, rock music declines, and that there's some pop music is okay, and that country western is the only kind of music where the CD has held its own because people want CDs when it comes to country music. Why do you think that is?
I guess all those pickup trucks have CD players.
Yeah. Well, doesn't everyone have a CD player?
Yeah, of course.
Why do you think rock music has suffered so much? Is it because there's too much of it around?
Possibly saturation. Possibly that there aren't any real geniuses out there at this point. I don't know. It's hard to say. But things run their course. I mean, there's been popularity and cycles for different styles of music over the years. But I think that the big question for all of the music producers now is, you know, what are we selling? And you know, so it's thrown a wrench in the works. And for many years, it was just a very straight ahead system. Everybody knew how it worked. You just made albums and you sold them and you kept playing pretty much the same kind of stuff. And it just worked. And now it doesn't work. And so everybody's sort of in a tizzy about where are we going from here, kind of.
From the point of view of the consumer, and I hate that word because we're someone who listens to music, I think of it as something more than a consumer.
Yeah, I would like to think that, yeah.
However, has this knife that's been stuck in the back of the industry been good for music? Or, in other words, before this revolution that really goes back to the transistor in many ways, there were a few dominant labels that made contracts with certain bands, and when you got a contract, you kind of almost had it made, not necessarily, but that was your necessary condition for making it, and you were bound to them, but they also promoted you and so forth. And now it seems that those big commercial labels, the only money that they're really – substantial money they're making is on the old-timers, and it's this whole nostalgia thing. They're not making money by marketing new bands and things
right.
of that sort. Whereas the movement among independent labels and musicians has exploded immensely.
Well, I think that the music the labels ate the seed corn. They basically – you know, consumed everything in sight and left nothing for the future. And they are no longer, you know, the original paradigm in the rock world, at least, was, you know, if you got signed, you had a 1 in 10 chance rather than a 1 in a million chance. But most of the groups that were signed never got the album out. Or if they did, they didn't get it promoted. Or if they got it promoted, their record exec left for another job or something, and suddenly nobody was taking care of their business and they just fell out of favor. So, you know, we keep thinking of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones as, you know, as the paradigm. But the real paradigm are, you know, people like my friends who got signed 3 times and never got an album out. So, yeah, you know, it's unfair to you know, make these sweeping generalizations about the music industry, because it was pretty variable. People with a lot of talent got nowhere, and people with very little talent got all the way. So, sure. Just, you know.
So we're in a better regime, you're saying?
Well, no, I think it's a wash. I mean, some things are better, some things are worse. The individual musician has a lot more access now to tools, but there's no market left. So, you know, you can make great music, but what are you going to do with it? But, you know, if there's one positive thing that comes out of this, I think it's going to be that all those musicians that got all the MIDI stuff and started working in their bedrooms are going to have to go play live somewhere. They're going to have to actually learn how to play an instrument and go out and entertain people. And that might actually create a whole new generation of musical performers, and it could just, you know, be another cycle. But at the moment, it's pretty much all live music. That's really where things have headed, and it's harder than it ever has been to make money selling recorded music. But
and I'm finding it's harder than it's ever been to hear live music. You know, when I came to Palo Alto 2 decades ago, there was live music very readily available. I don't know of one place anymore that has live music in Palo Alto. I'm sure there is. Christy could tell us.
Not as many as there used to be.
Not as many, no.
No, the Stone is gone. I know that.
So.
Keystone, I guess it was. Yeah, it's... There are still – well, there's been a consolidation in the industry too. So, in fact, just last week, the major live show producers, was it Live Nation, took over, I guess, Ticketmaster. So they now own the entirety of everything associated with live productions of big concerts. The local stuff is still out there. But, you know, there's really not much between your local bar and the Fillmore or the Warfield or you know, Bill Graham Presents. There used to be, and when I was in high school, the reason that my band was successful was there were a huge number of local venues, Longshoremen's Hall in San Francisco and the Roll Arena in San Leandro, where, you know, groups like the Yardbirds and Buffalo Springfield would play. You know, you were 4 feet from the stage, so it was just a very intimate thing. And like my band opened for Muddy Waters at the IDES Hall in Hayward, which is a Portuguese meeting hall that they rented out because it was idle on the weekends. And so that was the music business then. And then Bill Graham took things over, and that was the beginning of this consolidation of everything into one sort of big bowl. And now it's just gone to its logical conclusion. So there's humongous, and there's, you know, sporadic little things and nothing in between.
Yeah. Do you find a lot of musical talent at Karma when you get all those Stanford students coming in there?
Yeah, I really do. Yeah. And that's what gives me hope that there's these kids are actually the person that sent you that communication said that he doesn't think that young people understand what's going on inside. Well, he should come meet the young people at Karma, because they know more about a lot of this stuff than I do. And it's really pretty amazing. They not only know how to use the technology, but they know what's behind it. And, you know, when they come up to Karma, they're coming up there because they want to learn how to write their own software, how to make their own systems, how to design new instruments, how to basically use the power of the computer to do completely new and different things that old folks haven't even thought of. So,
so they're motivated more by a creative desire rather than technical.
I think they're
more
musicians. They're combining
the
two.
Yeah.
They have a creative bent, and they want to know how to use the technology in the pursuit of their creative desires, and that's the perfect combination.
Perfect until you have to go out there and perform. as you said, maybe it'll get them out of their rooms and make them learn how to play instruments.
These guys can put on – they can entertain you for a whole night with just their laptop.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's pretty amazing. I'm impressed with the kind of stuff that they do.
Speaking of the laptop, just to conclude, we were talking about everything that the transistor has done to revolutionize things. There was another article in the New York Times. Let's see. I know I brought it along, and it is about – not the Dateline, but it was an article about, Wi-Fi turns rowdy bus into rolling study hall. So it's about how, you know, the school bus at high school.
Oh, these kids, man.
They used to be rowdy. They, you know,
I rode on a school bus.
Jumping over seats and trying to
throwing spit wads out the window.
And all that kind of
stuff.
And now that they have everyone, there's a picture of it. It's, you know, a picture is worth 1,000 words. And it's about these kids all with their laptops without communicating to each other at all. Each is in his own, her own atomized world, which is completely asocial. And I think this is something that Jaron Lanier is lamenting, is that we're becoming MIDI bits or whatever.
Well, it's tempting, but that's, you know, the pursuit that will be taken by the lazy person. There's kind of a divide, I think. There's people who want to be entertained, and they're the ones that will sit in front of the TV and watch anything. And obviously somebody is watching it because there's some really abysmal programs on. But then there's people that have something inside of them that they have to get out. And those people are not going to, you know, be anesthetized by the availability of this stuff because they have an inner drive. And I don't know that that's going to be changed by, but the average person never was, you know, a real creative genius. And so, you know, they've got a lot more things they can watch now, people falling off buildings and all that really cool stuff. But there is also, you know, science channels and biography channels. And there are avenues you can pursue. And, you know, the World Wide Web, there's a lot of crap. But there's also a lot of really brilliant information and really well-presented coursework. And, you know, a lot of, you can get a university education for free if you know where to look. Yeah. So, it cuts both ways. And I think that really it all comes back to human nature. And unfortunately, human nature hasn't changed since, you know, fire. So, we're in the same boat we've always been in. It's just it's a lot easier to dig a hole in the boat.
Well, that's why I always enjoy talking with you about these things, Jay, because you're always correcting my apocalyptic scenarios, which is that it's not all constant, that the good and the bad don't always balance out in the end, but that there's something much more demonic maybe about the contemporary technology. But I hope you're right.
I think the technology isn't what we need to worry about. It's what's inside of people that we need to worry about. And like I say, that doesn't show much sign of changing. Mm-hmm. The technology only makes it easier for them to bang each other in the head.
That's true. Well, this is an occasion to tell our listeners that I think that for the spring quarter, we're going to try to do as many shows on music and a long promised show on Pink Floyd and the Doors and other things. And this is an excellent prelude to a kind of spring season that's going to be heavy on the musical theme. So thanks for coming on, Jay. Maybe we'll get
my pleasure.
Back in the spring
I'd love
more
to.
About rock music.
Oh, yeah.
So we've been speaking with Jay Kadis from Karma here at Stanford. I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions. Tune in next week. We'll be with you again. Thanks a lot. Take care.